and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
We are for the EU and against this EU. I mean, the question is the EU reformable? Well, we like to say the EU is not reformable, but it is transformable.
We discuss the future of the European Union. And this month, I'm afraid it's that B word again, Brexit. It's like a vortex that's sucking away attention on all the really crucial underlying structural challenges of our times, on economics, climate crisis and inequality. But it does also represent the struggles we face between the interests of big business, elite power and the public interest. No time for headlines this month. We're going to go straight to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this crazy month.
Okay, John, we've had a very dramatic set of events in Britain, all connected to the Brexit crisis. Let's talk about how the European Union should be dealing with what looks like is soon to be a post-Brexit Britain, which fully intends to behave pretty badly and be the neighbour from hell. How should the European Union deal with that?
Yeah, well, the neighbour from hell is... Yeah, a good way of looking at it. But by now, it's clear that Mr. Johnson's government plans to go full speed ahead on the race to the bottom strategy. And the name of this strategy is Singapore on the Thames. This is the Singapore on the Thames model we're talking about. And this week, he's been in the United States trying to drum up business. And the offer to United States business people is all about tax cuts and special tax treatments and light touch regulation and more. And importantly, what Prime Minister Johnson was describing in New York this week, he was talking about accelerated facilities for United States businesses to fast-track government procurement contracts. And that will presumably include contracts to take over an even larger share of Britain's National Health Service and Education Services and further inroads into privatising defence and related industries. So if we look at this strategy in the large, we see a significant shift away from the European welfare state model into the direction of the kind of laissez-faire capitalism associated with the Chicago School of Economics and with the kind of wilder extremes of the Republican Party in the United States. This race to the bottom model for post-Brexit Britain poses a particular challenge for the European Union. Either the European Union tries to outcompete Britain by allowing other member states like Luxembourg, the Netherlands and Ireland to deepen their tax haven model, and that means further tax cuts and deregulation, which will only make matters much, much worse in a continent which has already seen political fragmentation right the way across many countries. Or, and this is the major alternative, is to take effective countermeasures against this race to the bottom which Britain is precipitating. So, to answer your question about what are the effective countermeasures that the European Union should be taking. Well, if we assume that Britain leaves the single market, either with or without a deal, British banks and insurance companies and the big law firms and so on will want to continue to have access to the single market of the remaining 27 European member states, because this is the largest market of its type for all of these services in the entire world. So after Brexit, the existing passporting rights, which allow British banks and insurance companies and so on to trade across the border in financial services and business services, those passporting rights go, and a new deal will need to be negotiated between Britain and the European Union to replace the passporting arrangements. Now, what Prime Minister May was pushing for in the last few years, and we can only surmise that Prime Minister Johnson will be chasing the same arrangement, is a deal based on what's called mutual recognition of regulatory standards, based on the idea of equivalence of the regulatory regimes in Britain and the EU. And I'll unpack that, because behind the jargon of equivalence and mutual recognition, it's a fairly simple idea. Financial regulation within the single market is shaped by a set of harmonised rules that apply to all of the existing 28 states. So when Britain leaves the single market, its financial regulations are likely to diverge because Boris Johnson has been signalling this, the Singapore and Thames model. So what Britain wants to negotiate is a deal that allows for divergence away from the harmonised rules and the harmonised rule book, whilst an acceptance that the rules prevailing in Britain are equivalent to the single market rules. Well, of course, that's rubbish. We all know that.
The City of London's compliance is absolutely terrible already, and it's going to get worse if what Johnson wants comes to pass.
Well, that's right. Mr. Johnson plans to diverge significantly away from the EU rulebook, especially in matters relating to, for example, tackling financial speculation, tax fraud, countering money laundering. And worse, as you say, the regulatory authorities in London are notoriously under-resourced, and the consequence is that they're ineffective to the point that compliance is just hopelessly compromised. I think the European Union needs to play hardball in its negotiations with the British government. If the city wants to retain access to the single market for financial services, it must be genuinely equivalent in terms of the standards it applies, and this must not just apply to the city, but also to the whole of Britain's spider's web of offshore tax havens, the Bermudas, the Cayman, the Channel Islands, the British Virgin Islands, and all the rest. And that should extend to compliance with all European measures, including, you know, for example, the anti-avoidance directive, the anti-money laundering directive, which needs to be revamped, and with all the emerging measures which Europe is taking to tackle tax fraud and money laundering in the cryptocurrency markets. Now, the sting in the tail here is that under existing legal rules, trade in services based on recognition of equivalent standards allows for either state party to revoke on a declaration of equivalence, giving just 6 months' notice. In other words, if the European Union doesn't think that Britain's complying, then it gives 6 months' notice and you lose access to the single market. So this puts the European Union into a very powerful position to strike a deal based on detailed agreements of the definitions, on the rules, of the regulatory standards and all of those things. And then they can review these at regular intervals, maybe once a year or even more frequently, to ensure that Britain is not backsliding into degraded rules and light touch regulation. So the ability to revoke recognition of equivalence offers a really powerful tool to ensure that Britain doesn't engage in this race to the bottom on financial regulation. And on the matter of tax competition, the road ahead is really quite clear. Europe must push ahead with corporate tax reform, drop the existing model, which is based on the arm's length method and the separate entity principle, and it needs to adopt its proposed common consolidated corporate tax base with an agreed minimum rate somewhere in the range of 25% to stop this dynamic of the race to the bottom.
Right, and there are other things too that the European Union as a bloc has the power to do in terms of economic and tax policy, right?
Yeah, and you know, if you look at where Europe's been heading for many years, it's been in the grip of an obsession for so-called competitiveness, a very kind of neoliberal obsession, and that's been driving a race to the bottom political dynamic, which in practice over the last 20 years has harmed investment, increased inequality and fueled the re-emergence of fascist politics in so many different countries. Now, this competitiveness agenda, as we like to call it, applies particularly in the area of tax. And that's been made worse by the failure of the European Union to adopt effective countermeasures to protect member states from having their domestic tax policies undermined or eroded by the predatory tax regimes of tax havens within the European Union itself, you know, the Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Ireland, and of course Britain. So we've seen this competitiveness agenda fueling a race to the bottom, and Europe needs to break away from that. Now, the argument put forward by conservative political power blocks within the European Union is that harmonisation of fiscal policies erodes national sovereignty on tax matters. But stop and think about this, because this argument falls apart in an era of complete capital mobility, dominant transnational companies and tax havens, because wealthy elites and transnational companies can easily shift their wealth and their profits offshore, which is exactly what's been happening within Europe. So our argument turns this national sovereignty issue onto its head. In order to protect national sovereignty on tax matters, the European Union must create effective international frameworks to, for example, enable cross-border cooperation, effective information exchange, for example, effective rules on tax transparency, country-by-country reporting, for example, and on tackling money laundering, and also effective rules to block so-called spoiler states, that is the European tax havens, from undermining the tax sovereignty of other countries. Now, of course, some of these rules are already in place in the European Union. We already, for example, have rules on country-by-country reporting by transnational companies. We have directives on anti-tax avoidance measures and public registries of beneficial ownership. They're not perfect, but it's a work in progress. As I said earlier, the EU also needs to move towards a harmonised tax base for transnational companies, and that's the Common Consolidated Corporate Tax Base. And that tax base needs to be backed by an agreed minimum tax rate to block this race to the bottom on tax rates. Now, the good news here is that the incoming EU president, Ursula von der Leyen, has already announced that tackling tax evasion, tackling tax avoidance and money laundering will remain a priority during her presidency. And that, I think that's good news. She has also instructed Frans Timmermans, the commissioner responsible for working up a European Green New Deal, to work with Paolo Gentiloni, and he's the incoming commissioner for economic affairs, to introduce a new tax on fuels which emit greenhouse gases, and also to work on a new carbon border tax to block countries from importing fossil fuels which haven't had a carbon tax imposed upon them. So we're seeing tax justice now moving into the environmental sphere at a European Union level. And this, I think, is very good news.
And some attempt at harmonisation so that member states aren't undermining each other as they do in other tax policy.
Yes, that's exactly it, because as long as you have a harmonised approach, the rules of the market apply consistently across the market, then you flip the competition. It's the companies that have to compete rather than the countries that have to compete. And that's what economics is all about, you know.
And some things that are currently sustainable because of subsidies would no longer be sustainable, presumably.
Well, yes. I mean, if for example, we removed all the fossil fuel subsidies from the European markets, then I think you see a much faster energy transition away from a hydrocarbon economy towards a more renewable-based economy. So if we kind of get back to the big picture, the EU now faces a crossroads. On the one hand, it can choose to carry on with tax competition, forced to do this much as anything else by its bad neighbour in Brexit land. And that'll lead to a general race to the bottom, which will undermine national tax sovereignty. Or, on the other hand, it can opt for greater cooperation and harmonisation on minimum tax rates to block tax competition. So if it chooses to move towards harmonisation of tax rates and in order to block tax competition, it will also need to drop the rule which requires total consensus, unanimity of voting on votes relating to tax matters. That's a crucial political barrier to change here.
Right, and the problem with that is that one nation state can undermine any movement forward and any kind of significant reform. And really, it's logical that, there'll always be at least one dissenting voice, and therefore the majority should carry forward what the majority agrees.
Yeah, well, that's democracy, isn't it? Because for years, in fact, for decades, we've seen so-called spoiler states. And, you know, we can name them Luxembourg, Ireland, United Kingdom.
Britain, yes.
Yeah. And for years, they've been using this vote to block progress. I think the European Union now needs to move towards majority voting in this area. Because I call this Europe's Hamilton moment. And that's because way back in 1790... the US Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, he recognised that tax competition could wreck the newly emerging United States of America. And so he advocated for deeper union on the grounds that, and I'm quoting here from his own words, this deeper union would contribute in an eminent degree to an orderly, stable and satisfactory arrangement of the union's finances. So that was recognised in the 18th century. There's a real danger of tax competition undermining the ability of states to protect their citizens. And I think it's time that the European Union recognised that tax cooperation in these areas will actually protect national sovereignty, not undermine it.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Across the political divide, there are those who support the EU remaining in the UK and those who support leaving, but for a whole spectrum of different reasons. Many politicians want to remain because they're very happy with the neoliberal policies of the European Union. Some want to leave because they think this Singapore on the Thames idea is a great way to go. Others want to leave because they don't like the EU's social policies like the minimum wage and other workers' rights. Others want the UK to leave because they think the UK has the potential to be freer from those neoliberal economic policies, which have, after all, supported toxic banks above all else. Just look at how excessive bank loans to Greek politicians who should have known better were protected by the EU, while Greece was sacrificed. From a tax justice point of view, the European Union has tackled tax dodging by multinationals. It has taken on state aid cases, but it hasn't faced up to the fact that European countries are themselves responsible for massive tax havenry and financial secrecy. Corporate lobbying and influence is out of control in the European Union, just as it is in many nation states. We've said before on the TaxCast how the UK, once it's outside the European Union, will get eaten for breakfast negotiating on trade and tax. And as we discussed in edition 92 last month, the National Health Service in the UK and public health models elsewhere are at grave risk as the UK market gets delivered belly up to the United States. So, what are the possibilities for the European Union?
We are facing a systemic crisis in Europe. And the one thing we have not done is to deal with it systematically.
This is Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece. He tried to protect Greece from the European Union's harsh bailout conditions and ultimately failed. Yet, he still campaigned for Britain to remain in the European Union. He co-founded DiEM25, or the Democracy in Europe movement. They believe that if it's not transformed, the European Union will disintegrate.
So DiEM25 decided to do that which the European Commission, the European Parliament, our governments have not done, to come up with a comprehensive policy framework which consists of realistic, pragmatic policies which could be implemented tomorrow morning, and therefore radical policies, because compared to what we've been doing all these years, which is simply to extend the crisis into the future by pretending that we've solved it, compared to this extend and pretend tendency, none of them are asking the question, what is going on in Europe and what should we do with the architectural design, with economic and social policy at the level of Europe?
And that business-as-usual mindset he's referring to is failing as a bloc to tackle predatory capitalism, to tackle the finance curse, the climate emergency, to deploy good economics in the public interest, and to implement healthy, genuine investment, which is key to more equal societies.
My sense is that the European Union, like the nation state was 100 years ago, 150 years ago, is this fortified, you know, anti-democratic structure around which we need to mobilize to democratize, and that there are real progressive possibilities on that horizon towards a kind of transnational solidarity, democracy that links the peoples of Europe who were otherwise riven by nationalist tendencies and xenophobic anxieties to be part of a single project. So that's what I would say is sort of the promise and the positive vision.
This is DiEM25 Policy Director and Green New Deal for Europe Coordinator David Adler.
Maybe rebuilding trust isn't the right place to go, because it implies that there is some part of recent history in which the European Union or the European community would have been a seriously progressive force that was giving voice to workers as opposed to acting in the interests of oligopolistic industrialists. And our position as DiEM25 is that we are for the EU and against this EU. Remain was a terrible framing around that whole project, because it implied such an attachment to a status quo. And that forced a lot of even progressive politicians to do a lot of apologizing for the European Union when they shouldn't. It was the grave fault of the Remain camp to create a kind of coalition, this cross-class coalition that included these hyper-bourgeois tax-evading figures like David Cameron with more progressive elements of, solidaristic leftism into a single coalition that seemed to be speaking with one voice.
Right. And can we really democratise EU decision-making, make it more transparent, reduce the risk of corporate capture and influence? How do you go around reforming such a huge bloc, such a complex group of countries?
I think the simplest and the most honest answer to your question is to say, I don't know. I mean, the question is the EU reformable? Well, we like to say the EU is not reformable, but it is transformable. You know, the reason why we don't know is because a unified, radical, progressive movement to democratize Europe has never actually emerged. We've never built the kind of movement that we in DiEM25 are calling for, which is to say all of the countries across Europe speak together, demanding a set of changes, democratizing this block of institutions that is otherwise quite resistant and repellent to calls for democratic reform. You and I may disagree on whether or not there is a progressive seed at the heart of the European Union. I happen to think there is. As a committed internationalist, I think that there's something really exciting about stitching these countries together to redistribute resources, to, you know, coordinate action on things like climate. I think that that's very exciting.
And times have changed now, right? Politically, with the Brexit experience, at least so far.
Yeah, so favorable opinion of the European Union has never been higher. We're not in 2015 anymore. In 2015, you could make a reasonable play in France, in Germany, in Italy, certainly. You can make a reasonable play to exit the Eurozone, definitely, and to exit the European Union altogether, right? There was a reasonable wave of support and anti-Brussels sentiment. We don't live in that world right now. We live in a world where, because of Brexit, largely because of Brexit, and the sense of the cost and complexity of exiting the European Union, no one really wants to do that. So in the last 3 years alone, we've seen a swing of upwards of 12% of favorability towards the European Union. The arrogance of some of the European leaders who were on their heels a few years ago thinking about what do we do with the European Union is quite back. And now there's this kind of indifference when it comes to, you know, do we have to change the European Union because Britain has been so badly beaten back that I think there's a sense that actually everything's all right. Okay, so what does that mean? What that means is that campaigning to exit now, which is, there is no political opportunity structure to do that. So what we need to do is we need to get all those anti-EU leftists, you know, or rightists, whatever, to join together with all the progressive forces and anti-Semitic liberals, whatever, to make a broad coalition of people who are going out and mobilizing people to democratize the European Union. And if we fail in that process, if we actually give it a real full-throated shot, we build that coalition, we build that movement, we take to the streets, we demand those changes, we still aren't able to move an inch in that right direction, then yeah, let's give up. But the point is that there are so many avenues that are exciting towards repurposing those institutions to progressive ends that we have to give that a shot. We have to see if we can deliver the kinds of a democratic constitution for Europe, if we can deliver the massive Green New Deal program that will tackle the crises of austerity and ecological breakdown, and that we have to band together to do that.
If that sounds hard, the alternatives look harder. And Britain's looking like it's going to provide a painful example of a nation unilaterally trying to protect itself from predatory multinationals and trade deals. Good luck implementing fair tax policy and enforcing financial transparency. Here's Yannis Varoufakis again on just a few of the EU transformations DiEM25 wants to see.
We need, we believe, at least five policies. One, we need to tame the financial sector, to tame banks, to tame the bankers, and to democratize money and credit. We need to create a regulatory system that prevents banks from being toxic. It is preposterous that Deutsche Bank has six times the exposure, six times the size of Germany's national income. No bank in Europe should have more than 20% exposure of the country's gross domestic product. There should be very harsh limitations regarding bets and wagers and the equity ratio of banks. There should be, most certainly, a new public digital payment system that competes with the private payment system of the banks. Secondly, we need to fund green investment. It is ludicrous that in Germany today, when interest rates, the cost of borrowing money is zero, sometimes negative, you have the lowest level of investment in your history and the highest level of savings. You only need to state this to realize that we are all in trouble. If Germany, with zero interest rates and surpluses everywhere, has the lowest level of investment since 1950, then you know that this Europe is simply not sustainable. So we need to create an alliance, a partnership between investment banks like the KfW, like the European Investment Bank, and central banks, so that the money printing capacity of the central banks is harnessed, to create investments into the things that we need to grow and disinvestment in the things we want less of, like diesel-powered cars, for instance. So we need to fund the innovators, but at the same time, we need to fund the society's maintainers, those good people who provide care in the communities, who look after all these processes that are not high-tech and innovative, but are essential, like those who clean the sewers, those who replace electricity lines, those who look after schools and hospitals. So we need basic good provision, and that needs to be funded properly. Fourthly, have you noticed that increasingly, with the use of digitization and artificial intelligence, social capital is multiplying? Every time I can see somebody here looking on their phone, every time you check on Google something, you search, you are contributing to the capital of Google. But Google is not sharing its income with you. So capital is becoming socially produced increasingly, but privately exploited. We need a universal basic dividend. We need a part of the shares of corporations to be publicly owned so that the dividends, the income that they produce, is distributed across society. If we don't do this, with automation exponentially rising, we're going to have more inequality, more instability, and in the end, even the corporations are going to suffer. And lastly, we need to defeat the euro crisis. We can reconfigure and recalibrate and redeploy existing institutions like the European Investment Bank, like the European Central Bank, like the European Stability Mechanism to deal with simultaneously the creation of more fiscal space for our governments, a proper banking union, a restructure of all public debt in Europe without haircuts, and an investment-led recovery program for the Eurozone. If you read our European New Deal paper, we are proposing the creation of some very important new institutions that can be done on the basis of enhanced cooperation, which is already part and parcel of the panoply of the European Union. It's in the Lisbon Treaty. Create a European equity depository, a social wealth fund for Europe as a whole. The funding for that fund should come from the profits of our central bank. Do you know how much profits the ECB makes every year? Huge quantities from all these dealings in purchasing bonds and corporate debt, from the Target 2 intra-European payment system, from the dividends of corporations that I mentioned, from a share of the monopoly profits that corporations make from intellectual property rights, from a pan-European inheritance tax, and finally, from a pan-European carbon tax. These funds must go into a common social wealth fund for Europe as a whole. We call it the European Equity Depository, from which to fund the basic goods that I was referring to before and the universal basic dividend. Our European New Deal agenda is also presenting what we should do tomorrow morning in the very short term. For instance, the public digital payment platform, we can implement this in less than a month. The anti-poverty scheme that we need in order to solidify Europe can be funded tomorrow morning from the profits of the European Central Bank. The European Investment Bank and KfW, European Central Bank Alliance, it only takes one announcement to start activating it. This can be done within a month. In the medium term, we are proposing the new bank regulation regime, the housing and jobs guarantee scheme, as well as the green transition investment program. And in the longer term, the activation of the universal basic income. And once we have stabilized Europe and we have produced hope again, then we can sit around the table as European citizens to discuss how we're going to draft that which we are missing. A democratic constitution for Europe that replaces all the treaties and which gives Europeans an opportunity to create a European demos and put the demos back into democracy.
David Adler again of DiEM25 and the Green New Deal for Europe.
We spent the last year building Europe's first transnational party that we called European Spring, that was going to be stringing together parties and building ones where we didn't have them to develop that. You know, and my job as the policy director was to build the first real manifesto, 100 policies across these 12 pillars of how do we put together the political priorities of progressives in Denmark and Poland and Portugal and Greece and Germany to form a single vision. And that's all very novel still. So I think that there are a class of technocrat and a class of elite that gain tremendously from coordination failures and communication failures across the continent. So the more these countries are unable to speak to each other and coordinate with each other, and the people in those countries are, you know, not sort of conscious of their overlapping interests with their next door neighbors, and they're sort of divided like the Germans have been against the Greeks, the better off are these elites who can play those countries off each other. And when it comes to Brussels, just rely on the sort of political gridlock to sustain the status quo. So we're really trying to move towards that kind of social integration.
Absolutely. And obviously, I'm going to have to talk to you about tax, tax transparency. And obviously, it's got to be a central part of transformed Europe. You know, automatic information exchange, beneficial ownership registers of all secret sorts of financial vehicles, you know, country by country reporting. We need to see wealth taxes, green taxes, got to be all central, right, to the coordinated response to the climate and austerity crisis. How does that play a role in the sort of the Green New Deal vision?
Well, I mean, I think it's the first place to start. These things have to start with taking seriously the problem of tax evasion. For example, when the European Union is willing to blacklist tax havens outside of Europe, but is unwilling to take any accountability for the tax havens that exist inside of it, whether that's in Ireland or it's in Luxembourg, or, you know, whether it's talking about golden visa programs in Greece or golden passport programs in Malta that allow for, you know, money laundering, tax evasion, et cetera. All of these schemes are passing through Europe constantly, and we just haven't had the political capital, the political will to do anything about it. My sense is that, you know, any project of transforming Europe, whether it has to do with attacking some of the underpinnings of austerity, which depend on this notion of real scarce resources, you know, we don't have any money, we have to continue to give these gifts to oligarchs who are just going to take their money elsewhere, or it has to do with the fact that, you know, we can't possibly move to stanch the ecological crisis because, you know, how could we possibly muster that kind of power for the public purse? And where you have this obsession with balanced budgets that's really starved the European continent of investment. Europe is in dire need of appropriate fiscal interventions, which I think is pretty obvious when you look at decaying infrastructure all across the continent. You know, and Spain, like Greece or like Italy, has huge youth unemployment rates. So we need to get those investments off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I'm often thinking that we're on the cusp of sort of political renaissance in some ways, just because the old voters are dying, to be honest with you. And I just sort of think, can we afford not to transform the EU? Can Europe really afford to fail?
No, it absolutely can't. We're looking at a situation of seriously dwindling numbers of even vaguely committed liberal democracies, and a real assault, a global assault on human rights in my country of origin, the United States, is no exception. So no, I don't think that Europe can afford to fail for those political reasons or for just plainly ecological ones. And that the European Union as a transnational bloc has not only the potential to show off what a coordinated response to the ecological crisis would look like, but set an example for the world about how countries can work together and coordinate their energy union. Ultimately, Brexit is a giant distraction. And I completely agree with your assessment that this was about realigning Britain away from the more social, green policies of Europe and towards the more sort of psychotic libertarian ones. Mostly, it's been a way of getting people in Britain not to think about anything for 3 years, to be so caught up in the business of Brexit that they've been unable to think past it about how to respond to much larger political questions.
You've been listening to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. You can find out more about DM25, its manifesto, and the Green New Deal for Europe on www.dm25.org. There's also the book A Vision for Europe, published by Eris Press, www.eris.press. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.